was doing a Google search on how to break bad habits. And of course, anytime you do a Google search, you're going to get results from that vary anywhere from the sublime to the ridiculous. And the most ridiculous thing I saw was this link. It said, how to break bad habits, 27 steps to make quitting easy. Let me tell you, if I got to do 27 steps to quit something, I'll just keep doing it, because 27 steps is just way too complicated. Probably the best advice I've ever seen as far as breaking bad habits is this: if you can't stop, don't start. Just don't start the bad habit to begin with. Just avoid it altogether. I realize that if you're caught in a bad habit, that's probably not the best advice to give, and the Bible does address how we can break bad habits, but the concept of avoiding things that are unnecessary, avoiding things that can lead you to bad places, that's a pretty dominant theme in the book of Proverbs. And I want us to look tonight at Proverbs chapter 6. And the thing that Proverbs chapter 6 says over and over is, avoid this. Don't get entangled with this. Don't get involved in this particular thing, or don't get involved with this particular purpose. That seems to be the common thing that unites all of Proverbs chapter 6. So I want us to continue our study of the first 9 chapters of Proverbs, where we're talking about uncommon sense, and look at this interesting chapter. When you look at the chapter as a whole, it's basically a list of people and things to avoid. He talks about avoiding loans, avoiding loafers, avoiding lowdowns, and avoiding liaisons. And some of these more involve people than they do circumstances. Others involve circumstances more than they involve people. But I want us to look at each of these units in turn. Starting out with some interesting advice about loans, he says in the first few verses, "My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you have given your pledge for a stranger, if you are snared in the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself, for you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go hasten and plead urgently with your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler." So in these first 5 verses, he's urging his son, don't put up security for a loan. Now, I think it's interesting the tact that Proverbs takes, in fact, really the tact that the Old Testament takes in general about loans. It was legitimate to loan money or to loan something to someone, but if it was a fellow Israelite, you could not charge interest. If you go back to Exodus chapter 22, for instance, Exodus 22 down in verse 25, Exodus 22, verse 25, it says that if you lend money to any of my people, so fellow Israelites, with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. So you start with your fellow Israelites. Generally, the Old Testament taught, if you loan money, you cannot charge interest. So there was nothing wrong with loaning money. Now, the law also said that if you were dealing with a foreigner, yes, you could charge interest. Deuteronomy 23, down in verse 19 and 20, "You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. You may charge a foreigner interest, but you may not charge your brother interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you do undertake in the land that you are entering to take possession of it." So you could charge a foreigner. What you could do, though, you could require security, or some kind of collateral from the person who is receiving the loan. Generally, it's the cloak, that person's outer garment, and you can only keep it for a day at a time. We'll not look at the passages that involve that. But generally, the Old Testament teachings on that were, don't loan money at interest to a fellow Israelite. You can charge interest to a foreigner. If you take someone's cloak or some personal piece of property for collateral, you have to return it by the end of the day. Now, if it was a long-term loan, I don't know if you went to their house every day and kept getting the cloak, but nonetheless, there were restrictions placed upon that. And then finally, the thing that really impresses me, you see it in Deuteronomy 15, for example, in verse 1, at the end of every 7th year, If you still owed a debt, the person you owed it to was required by law to forgive the debt, wipe the slate clean. What this was intended to do was create a fair and equitable system among the Israelites. It was encouraged to promote generosity and so forth. But the thing that interests me in Proverbs, the emphasis is not on loaning money or having to get a loan from somebody else. The consistent thing in Proverbs is don't give security. Don't co-sign for somebody else's loan. Look in chapter 11. Go to Proverbs for a moment. Chapter 11, verse 15. Whoever puts up security for a stranger will surely suffer harm, but he who hates striking hands in the pledge is secure. In chapter 17, down in verse 18. One who lacks sense gives a pledge and puts up security in the presence of his neighbor. In chapter 20, down in verse 16, chapter 20, verse 16, take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for foreigners. Chapter 22, verse 26, be not one of those who gives pledges who put up security for debts. And then finally, chapter 27, down in verse 13, take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger and hold it in a pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress. Over and over, it just says, don't be a co-signer on this debt. That's how we would word it today. Don't be a co-signer in this debt. And I think there's probably two reasons for that. Number one, if a person had to have a co-signer on a loan, most likely that person is in shaky financial situation to begin with. Secondly, the people who were most likely to co-sign were people who were tender-hearted, but their finances may not have been a whole lot better than the person they were helping. So it would get two people in disaster rather than one. And I can probably think of a third reason, and that is this. Over and over in the book of Proverbs, the emphasis is upon being generous. Rather than trying to take advantage of someone else and get interest from them, rather than trying to be a do-gooder and co-sign a loan, how about this? Just give them the help they need. Don't give it as a loan. Give it as a gift. In Proverbs chapter 28, down in verse 27, whoever gives to the poor will not want, but he who hides his eyes will get many a curse. In chapter 29, verse 7, a righteous man knows the rights of the poor, and a wicked man does not understand such knowledge. And again in verse 14 of chapter 29, if a king faithfully judges the poor, his throne will be established forever. And then one other verse along this line, chapter 22, down in verse 9, whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. What Proverbs says is it warns against this giving of the giving of security in this loan. But it also says the better thing to do is to be generous. Instead of giving it as a loan, give it as a gift, because that would really help the person the most. And so I would suggest that as far as practicability for us, and that admonition, as far as practical applications, this is a passage that yet again in Proverbs deals with stewardship. That's one of the most common themes, I think, in the book of Proverbs, is good stewardship. Take care of the possessions that you have. Take care of how you use them. Take care of how you use them in relationship to other people. Be generous in your willingness to help other people. I think Christians could learn a lot from that. Learn to be generous. Don't try to do things with strings attached. Very often, that's where the trouble starts. Very often, well, I'll loan you this, and that'll help you get back, and they can't pay the loan, and now you've got double trouble. You got two people that are upset, and they're upset with each other, and that relationship has been breached. I remember many years ago, I knew of a situation in the congregation. I wasn't there at the time it happened, but there was a young man in the congregation. He had always wanted to start a restaurant. He came from a restaurant background. His dad owned a restaurant. He always wanted to start a restaurant, and so there were several pretty well-off members in that congregation, and he talked them into loaning him some money to start it up. Well, it ended badly. His restaurant failed. He made one bad decision after another. And then on top of that, he skipped town, owing a whole lot of people money, And then on top of that, he took some restaurant equipment with him that he still owed money on. I mean, it was just a complete disaster. The thing that really struck me, though, I mean, this was years later, these guys were talking about, I mean, they would just get angry, red in the face, when they talked about loaning this guy money. The thing that really surprised me is the men that loaned him money, they were really astute business people. They really were. And I think they knew this was a bad risk, but because they tried to be nice about it, they entered into it on a loan basis, and everybody got burned. Everybody got burned, and there were hard feelings, and they persisted for years. Sometimes the best thing to do is either do one of two things. Either say, no, I don't think this is a worthwhile risk, so I'm not loaning you anything, I'm not giving you anything. If you do believe it's a worthwhile risk, say, here's a gift, take it, use your best judgment, and be done with it. And that's certainly what Proverbs here is admonishing the reader to do. Don't enter into this kind of surety or security for a debt, because it creates all kinds of problems. So number one, avoid loans and loaners and all of that kind of situation. The better solution is to be generous. The second thing is to avoid loafers. Now, it's interesting, in the first part, in verses 1 through 5, he's addressing the son. In the second part, he's addressing the sluggard. It's advice to the sluggard, he says in verse 5, back in our text. He says, go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, without having any chief officer or ruler. She prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. So he starts out with a bit of advice. Now, this is the first occurrence in the book of Proverbs for the word sluggard. That has got to be one of the most colorful words in the Old Testament. I hear the word sluggard, and immediately a picture comes to my mind. Here is a good-for-nothing lazy bum. Here's someone who's slow, someone who's unambitious, someone who will do anything to get out of an honest day's work. What an interesting word. He is a sluggard. And he says, oh, sluggard, you need to take a lesson from nature. Now, what he advises here, and you see this a lot in wisdom literature, His advice is based on observation. And I think that's an interesting point that comes up over and over in the book of Proverbs. If you want to be wise, learn how to observe things. Learn how to observe things carefully and learn the lessons from it. So his advice is based on observation of what? Go to the tiniest little creature you can imagine. Go look at ants and learn something about work. And his description of the ants, scientifically, is probably not exactly right, because ants do have social structures, and ants do have ways of organizing their work. If you were just to look at them, they don't really look that way. You have this, what appears to be random activity by all kinds of little bitty creatures, and yet they get an amazing amount of stuff done. And so he says, go to the ant, O slugger, consider her ways and be wise, not having any chief or officer or ruler, they prepare the bread in summer and gather food in harvest. Sluggard, you really need to be that way. Maybe you don't belong to a big company. Maybe you don't belong to an organization where they're constantly organizing for you. Here, take a lesson from the ant. Just go do it. And there's an emphasis in Proverbs also on working hard in summer so you'll have the necessary provisions in winter, and that's the tack that he takes. So first of all, he gives advice to the sluggard, learn from the ant. They are purposeful, they are diligent, and they are productive. Then he turns and gives a warning, or perhaps a rebuke, to the sluggard in verse 9. Here's the sluggard's real problem. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? I love verse 10. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. When that alarm goes off, I'll hit snooze. And when it goes off again, I'll hit snooze again. And then when it goes off the third time, I'll hit snooze yet again, and snooze and snooze, and before long, who cares? Before long, oh, you just lay there in blissful slumber. I'll tell you what, around our house, the day starts early. And there's a lot of days I don't like the sound of that alarm clock. But nonetheless, When you got stuff to do, you got to get up and do it. And he says, that's your problem, O sluggard. You love sleep. You love the bed. You're too lazy to get out of bed. And so it's a direct rebuke to this man for his laziness. And there are consequences to this. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Looks like me sitting in my office with my feet propped up on the desk, leaning back in my office chair. You know, folding of the hands to rest. You can drift off to sleep. I'm actually thinking about deep things. At least that's what I tell myself. But it's so easy to do that, to let yourself go into this lazy mode. And he says, here's what will happen. Poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. It's a reminder that most of the consequences of our bad behavior are self-inflicted, and particularly with laziness. With laziness, you get what you deserve. You earn the poverty that comes from it. You earn the neglect. You earn all of those bad things. That's what happens to the lazy person. And the son is advised here in this chapter, don't be like that person. Don't be like the sluggard. Don't hang with him. Don't imitate him in any way, shape, or form. It's addressed to the sluggard, but it's also by implication addressed to the son. Then avoid the lowdowns. Now, I remember growing up, I used to watch all these old cowboy shows, and inevitably, in every cowboy show, there's a lowdown dirty somebody. Lowdown means mean-spirited. Lowdown means someone who is dishonest, someone who is unfair. And that's a pretty good description of what he's about to describe starting in verses 12 through 19. There's two parts to this. There are seven traits about this lowdown person. That's in verses 12 through 15. And then there is a list of seven abominations. This is an interesting passage because it organizes his information around a numerical theme. Now, he lists the numbers in the second part. He doesn't mention it in the first part, but they're both structured around the number seven. And I think these two units belong together. The second unit, starting in verse 16, doesn't have a formal introduction the way that this other section has. So in verse 12 through 16, he starts, or through 15, he describes seven traits of this particular person: a worthless person, a wicked man, goes about with crooked speech, winks with his eyes, signals with his feet, points with his finger, with perverted heart devises evil, continually sowing discord. Therefore, calamity will come upon him suddenly. In a moment, he will be broken beyond all healing. Now, I want you to notice also, he uses some anatomy here. If you go back to chapter 4, remember, we had a sermon in chapter 4 in verses 20 through 27. You know, that we're familiar with verse 23 of chapter 4. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. That whole little stanza there, verses 20 through 27, is organized around anatomy. And here's another passage that's organized around anatomy. He talks here in verses 12 through 15 about speech, which is the mouth, eyes, feet, fingers, heart, and so forth. So he's using anatomy to kind of describe how thoroughly wicked he is. He's wicked from head to toe, is the point that he's making. And some of the specific things, he is worthless, and that's exactly what that word means. He has no value to humanity. He has no value to the community. He's not worth much. And that word is used quite a bit in the Old Testament. He's worthless, and he is wicked. That word was used, by the way, to describe Samuel's, sons. The word worthless was used to describe, Eli's sons in the book of Samuel. They were worthless men. They were men who had no value to the community of Israel. And that's a pretty strong indicator of the Lord's view of this kind of person. The rest of the list, I think, elaborates on why he is that way. He has crooked speech. You think of all the warnings in the book of Proverbs about speech, warnings against lies, warnings against gossip, warnings against slander, warnings against spreading of rumors. All those kinds of things constitute this crooked speech. The next three things I think are interesting in verse 13. Winks with his eyes, and the ESV says signals with his feet and points with his finger. Probably what he's emphasizing here is nonverbal communication, but we get the idea of someone winking with their eyes. They say something to you and they wink, and what they're saying is, my words and my meaning have two different things. You know, I'm saying this, but wink, wink, I actually mean something else. Here's a man, you can't trust his words. Or maybe he's talking to you, and the moment you look away, he winks at someone else because he's trying to take advantage of you. He knows it. The other person knows it. You don't know it. Using nonverbal communication as a way of deceiving you, I think, is the point that he's making. He signals with his feet. He points with his finger. Probably the same kind of thing. I'm not sure about foot signals. I don't give foot signals. I have trouble walking straight, so using them for signals would be difficult. But that may be what he's talking about here. And the idea of pointing with your finger, why do you point at someone? You're usually trying to shame them. You're chewing them out and you're pointing your finger at them and you want to make them feel about this tall. And so using the finger as a method of shaming someone. And that's the kind of way that he treats other people. The real problem is, according to verse 14, with perverted heart he devises evil. This is the reason for all things. Once again, Proverbs returns to the heart. In chapter 4, verse 23, guard the heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. Here's an example of what happens when you don't guard the heart. From the heart comes perverse, crooked, twisted, evil kinds of things. And then finally, we're told that he sows discord continually at the end of verse 14. He's not happy messing with you. He wants to mess with everybody. He's not happy when everybody else is happy, so he gets attention by trying to make other people miserable. He wants to be in control of this situation, and the best way he can do that is by being disruptive. You ever met anybody like that? Someone who is happiest when they're making other people upset. Someone who is happiest when they're stirring the pot, keeping things stirred up, making people angry, getting people upset, making you change your plans because of them. That's the kind of person he's describing here. Now, the second list starts in verse 16, and in many ways it's very complimentary. Here he actually uses the number 7. And by the way, verse 15, therefore calamity will come upon him suddenly. In a moment he'll be broken beyond healing. Once again, the self-imposed consequences of evil. You choose evil, there are consequences to that. And Solomon here wants his son to understand, you choose an evil path, there will be consequences. You'll be destroyed. Now, I believe he reinforces, I think the next paragraph is here to reinforce the point he's just made in verses 12 through 16. In fact, many of the items are almost the same. He uses that seven, that number seven, as a structural thing, and again, he appeals a bit, not all the way, but a bit to anatomy. Notice in verse 16, there are six things that the Lord hates. There are seven that are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Think about that list of seven abominations. One of the more familiar passages in the book of Proverbs. Really, all he's doing with this list is reinforcing what he says. Why is he called, back in verse 12, why is this person called wicked and worthless? Because the kinds of things that he engages in, and that's the function of this stanza, is that the kinds of things that he engages in are the very kinds of things that God abhors. And let me tell you, when the Bible says that God finds something to be an abomination, when God hates something, that's pretty serious. So this is an impressive list. It tells me that God takes these things very seriously. Now, what's on the list? Haughty eyes, using the eyes to convey the idea, I'm better than you. We have an expression in our language, you look down your nose at someone. That's using your eyes to show contempt. One of the ways that we do it in our culture is when people roll their eyes. We roll our eyes and kind of toss our head to one side. That's a sign of contempt. It means either I'm better than you or you're not good enough for me. I don't value your opinion because I don't value you. I don't like you. I don't think of you. You're nothing to me. You're nobody to me. You're dead to me is what we say. And that's the haughty eyes. Lying tongues. Tongues that do not speak truth. Truth is one of those things that is axiomatic for the people of God. If we don't engage in truth, we got problems. And truth can occur at several levels. Sometimes it's not being truthful with other people. Sometimes it's not being truthful with myself. And worst of all, it's when I'm not truthful with God. But lying tongues are an abomination to God. Hands that shed innocent blood. Murder is bad enough, and sometimes we see situations where two people go after it, and one of them kills another, and they both may share some guilt. Out where Nate is a member, congregation he's a member of, one of the members there is a homicide detective. And the last time I was out there, one of the members came up, asked how he was doing. He said, doing pretty good. He said, we closed a case today. And he started describing the case. He said it was actually what we call a twofer. You got two for the price of one. They solved one murder, and in the process, they solved another one. And he said in this particular case, the one guy that got killed was a really bad person, and we happened to catch the guy who did it. So they got two for the price of one. You hate even thinking about that. But he's not describing that situation here. He's not just talking about murder between two wicked people. He's talking about someone who is willing to put to death, someone who is willing to murder someone who is innocent. There is no reverence here for life. Remember back in chapter 1 of Proverbs, this is probably a short version of what we saw back in chapter 1, verse 11. One of the first pieces of advice that the father gives to the son is in chapter 1, verse 10, if sinners entice you, do not consent. What kind of sinners is he talking about? In verse 11 of chapter 1, if they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without reason. That's the kind of person he's describing. It's a gang mentality. It's a murderous mentality. He says, you don't want any part of that. Hands that shed innocent blood. And then he says, hearts devising wicked. This is the real problem. He goes back to the heart. What do you expect from someone whose heart is constantly thinking about evil things? You know, that's a real easy trap to fall into. You've got to guard against it. Again, Proverbs 4, verse 23, guard the heart with all vigilance. If you're not careful about what your mind takes in, if you're not careful about what you allow your mind to dwell on, you can become murderous and hateful and bitter. You can start thinking about evil. You start thinking about revenge. And that's a sure way to ruin your life as well as the life of someone else. It's so easy when somebody wrongs you to just think in your mind, oh, I'd like to do this. Oh, I'd like to do that. That person needs to be put in his place. And you let your mind go that way. And in your mind, you're thinking, oh, that's just delicious. I just want to picture this. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. There's nothing good about that. And so he warns here against these hearts that devise wicked, feet that pursue evil, constant curiosity about bad things. That's one of the reasons I really don't watch news anymore. I have not watched an evening news show for years. I just don't do it. I don't see that much good on it. If I want to find out what bad happened yesterday, when I log on to the internet in the morning, I can scan the headlines. If I want to read it, I'll read it. If I don't want to read it, I don't read it. Most mornings, I don't read it. A lot of bad stuff out there. And yet people will pursue evil. They hear about something, they run to it. They hear about something, they watch every video or news clip that they can. We feed on that kind of stuff, and it's evil. God hates that curiosity about evil. False witnesses, lying not just to others, but lying about others. You're willing to compromise somebody else's integrity because of your own moral shortcomings. And then finally, one who sows discord. Again, he ends this list much the same way that he did the other one. One more observation about this list of seven abominations. There's a number of things that aren't on that list. Don't think that this is an absolute thing. It has a context, and I think he's describing why the person described in verses 12 through 15 is such a worthless, wicked man, because he's practicing things that God abhors. There's no mention here, for example, of idolatry. Now, idolatry is a biggie in the Bible. Idolatry causes all kinds of problems for Old Testament Israel. There's not a single mention here about idolatry. So don't think of this as an absolute list. Also, in the context of Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, 5, 6, and 7 keep going back to the theme of adultery. Not a single mention here of adultery, which God absolutely abhors. And so don't think that this is the absolute end-all list of everything that God hates. There are plenty of things that God hates, plenty of things that are abominable to him. This is just a particular list that that is useful in this particular context. The last thing that he talks about, is the liaison. Now, we just looked at something in Proverbs chapter 5 a few weeks ago that I think is interesting, because in Proverbs 5, you're going to have advice very similar to what we're about to read in Proverbs 6, but I think there are a couple of differences that are worth noting. It's not just mere repetition. In Proverbs 5, he is clearly talking to a son who is married, because as he says, you know, stay away from this wicked woman, and then he says, instead, rejoice in the wife of your youth. So that man is married. I'm not sure if he's married or not in Proverbs chapter 6. So this would apply to anyone. Whether you're married or not, you need to follow this advice. If you're a single man, you need to follow the advice in Proverbs chapter 6. In Proverbs chapter 5, it could be a single woman because it never mentions her husband. Now, in Proverbs 7, he's going to describe one particular wicked woman who entices a young man by saying, you know, my husband's not home. And here at the end of chapter 6 of Proverbs, he is talking clearly about a woman who is married. So I think that's another change. In Proverbs 5, no mention of a husband, so she could be a single woman. Here, it's definitely talking about a married woman. I think in Proverbs 5, when it talks about the consequences, the emphasis there is on the intrinsic consequences. How it eats at you, how it destroys you from the inside. I think in Proverbs 6, he's very much talking about extrinsic consequences. What happens to you because of what you do? What does somebody else do to you? And so he's talking here about some external things. Now, with that in mind, he says in Proverbs 6, starting in verse 20, he says, my son, keep your father's commandments and forsake not your mother's teaching. Bind them on your heart always. Tie them around your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will talk with you. So he starts this very much like all the other fatherly lectures that he has. Listen to your father's teaching. Listen to your mother's teaching. Use it like a necklace. Wear it constantly. Have it constantly at hand. And here's the reason, verse 23, for the commandment is a lamp and the teaching a light. The reproofs of discipline are the way of life, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Now, by calling her an adulteress, you're obviously talking about some kind of marital situation. As you read on, you figure out the woman in this case is actually married. So that's the introductory part. Hang on to this wisdom that came from mom and dad, because this will keep you from this particular kind of woman. Now, here's the danger in verse 25. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, and do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. For the price of a prostitute is only a loaf of bread, but a married woman hunts down a precious life. Be careful what you look at. Be careful who you look at. That's pretty good advice. The portal for lust is your eyes. If you look at things you shouldn't be looking at, you are bound, almost inevitably, to commit lust. You think about David's situation in 1 Samuel chapters 11 or 2 Samuel 11 and 12. The whole thing starts out, he sees something he shouldn't have seen. Whether it was his fault or not, whether he should have been at the palace or not, whether she should have been bathing on the roof or not, sometimes you see things you shouldn't see. It could have ended right there, but it didn't. He looked at it, and then he thought about it. In this case, he says, don't let your eyes desire her beauty, and don't be caught by her glance. There are some women in this world who know how to use their eyes, they know how to use their looks, and they will use it to seduce you. And he says, son, don't be naive about that. Just because some good-looking girl throws a glance your way doesn't mean you have to take the bait. It's one thing to be nice to someone. It's one thing to admire someone because of their beauty. It's another thing to fall for the trap that they're laying. Don't be naive about this. So that is the danger. Watch your eyes. Guard your eyes. Be careful what you take in. And then he says, here's the real price of it. The price of a prostitute's only a loaf of bread, but a married woman hunts down a precious life. It will cost you your life in some way, shape, or form. Maybe you won't die from it, but your life will never, ever be the same once that line has been crossed. And then here's the consequences, starting in verse 27. He does this in two ways. He uses a couple of analogies. In verses 27 through 29, he uses the analogy of fire and then makes an application. And then in verses 30 through 35, he uses the analogy of stealing and then makes an application. The first analogy is, can you take fire in your bosom and not get burned? His point is, you commit adultery with another man's wife, you will get burned. You will get burned. It's like having your flesh set on fire. It's something that will cost you. Can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Here, the woman is married. Whether the man here is married or not, the woman is. You're messing with someone you shouldn't mess with. So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. That's the first consequence. You will get burned. The second consequence is a bit more elaborate. He says in verse 30, people do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his appetite when he is hungry, but if he's caught, he will pay sevenfold. He will give all the goods of his house. People may be sympathetic. He has a kind of a hypothetical situation. What if you're starving to death and you go steal a loaf of bread? There's a certain level of sympathy that exists for that, but you know what? If he gets caught, guess what? He still pays for his crime, right? How much worse do you think it is with adultery? With adultery, it's not because you have to have it. It's because you chose to do something that was wrong. And so he says, he who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. This is not like you're starving to death. This is simply inordinate desire at work. Unrestrained sexual appetite. That's the problem. And you lack sense when you do it. He will get wounds and dishonor and disgrace, and they will not be wiped away. And then there is the fact that you got to deal with the husband. And he says in verse 34, for jealousy makes a man furious, and he will not spare when he takes revenge. He will accept no compensation. He will refuse, though you multiply gifts. You can try to appease him. You can try to explain it. You can pay whatever fines, whatever you have to. It will not satisfy the jealous husband. So there will be steep consequences for doing that. And so the last piece of advice then in this chapter is avoid these sexual liaisons like the plague. It's not worth it. You will get burned and your life will never, ever again be the same. And so the point is, are you willing to accept that kind of price? One other point here, by using that analogy about the thief in verse 30 and 31, sexual immorality is a kind of stealing. You know, back in the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, the seventh commandment was, thou shalt not commit adultery. But do you remember the tenth commandment? You shall not covet your neighbor's anything, including your neighbor's wife. That helps us understand why adultery is a sin. It's a form of covetousness. It's a form of inordinate desire. It's a form of, here's something I want, I can't have it, and I will get it. It's called stealing. That's why in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, when Paul was talking about sexual immorality, he said in chapter 4, verse 6, do not defraud one another, is how the New American Standard renders it. ESV says, do not wrong one another, and the implication there is, don't steal from one another. You take another man's wife, you're taking something that doesn't belong to you. You're defrauding that person. Adultery ultimately is a form of stealing. And so he says, you don't steal something that doesn't belong to you, including your neighbor's wife. So that's the advice that he gives him. When you think about the book of Proverbs and the kind of wisdom that it dispenses, I would suggest there are two kinds of wisdom. There's positive wisdom and there's negative wisdom. Positive wisdom is what I think most of us think about. If I say, what is wisdom? What we're going to say is, well, it's having these deep insights that perhaps other people don't have. Or we look at situations and we see things the way they really are. We think about it in a positive way. But Proverbs chapter 6 takes a different tact. It says, let me tell you another form of wisdom. Another form of wisdom is, don't do stupid things. Sometimes wisdom is positive in the sense that we do wise and profound things. But there's a whole other kind of wisdom. Don't do things that hurt yourself. Don't do things that hurt others. Don't do foolish, harmful things. And I know a whole lot of people whose lives would be better off if they would follow that advice. Think before you act. Don't do the stupid thing. Don't do the thing that will bring you harm and bring you loss and break your relationships and harm your body and harm your mind and harm your spirit. Don't do it. Avoid them. Avoid them like the plague. That's the kind of wisdom Proverbs 6 deals with. It's a negative kind of wisdom, but let me tell you, I know a whole lot of people who need to do that. They need to quit making dumb decisions and start making wise decisions. And that's Solomon's advice here. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, we always want to end our services with an admonition, an exhortation to you to obey Jesus as Lord. And if you are a Christian, if you're not living the way that you ought to, we want to help you with that. If we can help you in any way tonight, we'd invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.